Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Normally good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today. Today we've got good, good, and crazy. Almost good across the board. Not quite there. But, Jim, we start with, I guess, the ongoing war on terror, even if we don't like to use that term in the administration. But the president today at the UN, and we should point out that as we record this, he's still giving his address at the United Nations. But the president said something, as you pointed out, is not something we expected him to ever say. And that is, the only language understood by killers like this, referring to ISIS and the Khorasan group and other Islamic radicals, is the language of force. And apparently that lesson has been learned a little bit in the last couple of days, namely due to the airstrikes the other night. The U.S., according to Reuters, believes that the Khorasan leader was killed in the U.S. airstrike. And at the same time, CNN reporting that maybe we didn't even try this, but we succeeded. We apparently killed the leader of the al-Nusra Front, a guy named Abu Yusuf al-Turki. And so their statement is, the Turk is dead. So, Jim, we've got dead terrorists, and the president's saying that that's a good thing.
You know, this gets even better, Greg, because as you were describing that, I'm kind of monitoring the speech and the reaction on Twitter. First of all, he says, oh, ISIS will only respond to the language of force. And as I said, boy, I really love that speech from President Rumsfeld. Do you realize what he's referring, the new phrase he used to refer to ISIS, al-Qaeda, and other affiliated groups? The network of death.
Ooh, I like that, actually.
Yeah. I mean, now, some of us may have, you know, nicknamed MSNBC that a while ago. But that just refers to their time slots and their viewership. No, like, this is a, you know, and people, it's not just me. People say, man, this is a George W. Bush speech, all right? He just said, I want to, like, live blog this. Or, you know, you and I can do Mystery Science Theater 3000. This may be the best speech we've ever heard the president give, because he said, those who have joined ISIL should leave the battlefield while they can. Somewhere Clint Eastwood and Dick Cheney are given a standing ovation and all that stuff. I want to hear the Team America music playing in the background as Obama gives this speech. And he also apparently really gave it to Putin as well. And so whether this is going to be more than one speech, we'll see. But think about this. Think about who the audience for this. The tone we're expecting from, you know, the president who's going to heal the world and reduce the oceans and reach out to our enemies with an outstretched hand and all that stuff. He's calling on Muslim communities to explicitly reject the ideology of ISIS. You know, this is like maybe one of the best speeches. And the fact that he's giving it at the United Nations and it's not just, you know, kumbaya talk is really pretty striking and really delightful from where I sit, Greg.
Jim, this is 2 days in a row we've given the president a spot in the good martini. There have been some who were saying as early as yesterday, I haven't seen anything in real-time response to this speech, that the president is saying this because we're 42 days out from a midterm election, that his party's not looking very good, and he's looking for a way to stop the bleeding. How big of a role do you think that is?
I'm not going to look, you know, a gift horse in the mouth. Right. People are saying, wait a minute, you got the wrong end of the horse when it comes to President Obama. If it takes a midterm election to get him to approach the threat of ISIS seriously and to kind of, like, I'm tired of basically being told that when ISIS is beheading people, we have to ask ourselves what we did wrong to anger them. And the entire idea that there's some sort of logic to the ideology of the jihadists, I wholeheartedly reject it. I wholeheartedly believe this moral equivalence. We are the good guys, they are the bad guys. And anything that gets Obama and the President of the United States addressing this term, this conflict in straight up moral terms, makes me a happy guy. Since we're talking about this as it happens, he's talking about contesting the space that terrorists occupy, including the internet and social media. So I guess we'll see. Finally, Attack Watch, and it will be utilized to something useful.
Yes, to actually stop real evil people, not just conservative critics of Obamacare. All right, on to the other good martini now, and this is courtesy of Breitbart. Sarah Palin will campaign for incumbent Republican Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas in Independence, Kansas on Thursday. Roberts is in need of help from the Tea Party favorite. As polls show, he trails independent Greg Orman in this fall's general election. We mentioned this race as a bad martini a couple weeks back when the Democrat dropped out so that the Democrat masquerading as an independent had a better chance to defeat Pat Roberts. Since that time, the state Supreme Court has allowed the Democrat to get off the ballot, even though it wasn't for emergency reasons. And so recent polls actually show Pat Roberts trailing, and he's obviously got issues like residency and how much time he spends in the state and all that kind of thing working against him at this point. But the race is still certainly winnable, and to have the figure of Sarah Palin, who's synonymous with the Tea Party after a tough primary challenge for Pat Roberts, is hopefully a good thing in the last month and a half here.
Yeah, I was at a conference a few weeks ago, and even though the topic of the panel that I was on had really nothing to do with Sarah Palin, somebody in the audience said, so could each one of you say in five words what you think of Sarah Palin? And I don't know if this was a troublemaker or just somebody who really had Sarah Palin on the brain, or people who wanted to watch, you know, right-of-center journalists kind of squirm as you try to summarize what you think of this, you know, multifaceted, very controversial figure in just five words. And I think one of the things I said was, you know, wasted potential, but there's hope, was my five words. And my attitude was, you know, I among others, were among those who really thought we had a striking political talent in 2008, didn't quite understand the decision to leave the governorship, or I understood it, but felt like it never really got well explained, and it really kind of took her out of a political role. I've never been a big fan of this idea of, well, I can have more influence outside the system. Well, then it means you're really not that good in the system, are you? Traditionally, you know, you don't seem to, I can change the system by not being part of it and by talking on cable news. So as somebody who has said some critical things of Sarah Palin in the past, I have to say 110% attagirl for all the argument that she's out for herself, or she's got this cult of personality. Here she is going to Kansas and going, you know, the extra mile to help somebody who probably doesn't agree with her all the time. Pat Roberts is not that much of a squish. I mean, he's a Kansas Republican. Serious questions about his residency. This is a guy who's really getting up in years and not necessarily having the spring in his step that he may have had in the past. This is Sarah Palin being a team player. And I think those of us who have been somewhat critical of her in the past have to applaud her and have to say, look, you know, some of the criticism against her isn't accurate, or she's proving it's not accurate because she's willing to go help somebody who doesn't check every box and align with everything she agrees with.
And we'll see if that has an impact and how that race trends. It's a weird year in Kansas since the Republican governor is in big trouble there, too, it would seem, from the latest polls. So on to the crazy martini now, and I'll let Jim describe this one for the most part, because it's a story that he did that just posted this morning on National Review Online, and it basically looks at a New York Times column by David Brooks, their resident conservative, although a lot of times he doesn't exactly line up with conservative ideology. And he spent a lot of time in this piece examining how great New York City is and how the revitalization of quote-unquote urban areas is fantastic, Jim. So I'll let you take it from there.
Sure. There are three major points in this column, and one or two of them you can make a decent case for, and others seem really off base. One being that people are too pessimistic. Snap Out of It is the title of it, and he feels like there's too much gloom. And I suppose I can see that point. I wrote something kind of similar in May, looking at the great advances we're seeing in cancer research, AIDS research, technological innovations. So, look, there, you know, the news isn't always bad, and I don't want Americans walking around in a depression. One part that jumped out of me and that irked me a great deal is that he says, you know, when I think about the 15 or 20 largest American cities, the same thought applies. You know, life is immeasurably better. Compared with all of the past periods, American cities and suburbs are sweeter and more interesting places. Those of you outside those 15 to 20 cities, life sucks. Too bad for you. You know, one, that seems like a really interesting measuring stick. There's never been a time when there are so many interesting places to visit, shop, and eat, when the rivers and the parks were so beautiful, when there are so many vibrant neighborhoods across all boroughs. You know what really helps to enjoy all those, Greg?
What's that?
Disposable income,
yes,
and the free time to enjoy it and not being stuck in a commute. What he's basically saying is life is really immeasurably better and sweet and more interesting for David Brooks. You know, and I'm glad, good for him. But, you know, like there is such a thing, you know, polycalism or basically, you know, walking around in a bubble and thinking that everybody's experience is like yours. He talks about, you know, reduction in global poverty. Well, that's great. You know, there's this thing going on called the Great Recession. In my article today, I kind of lay out, like, a lot of Americans are still not recovered from where they were in 2007. The Fed did a report that basically said, you know, it cost each household in America anywhere between $50,000 and $120,000. 40% to 90% of 1 year's economic output. That's their lost wealth, drop in income, discounted future wage income from unemployment, and so on. I mean, it, you know, the So it goes through this whole lengthy stretch of happy talk, and I just kind of feel like it's downplaying the seriousness of the problems that face us. And then he starts talking about leadership. There's kind of like, if you think of a Venn diagram, David Brooks and I both probably agree that there are some serious problems with American leadership right now. He describes a certain tone of wealthy people separating themselves from everyone else. And one of the things is, you know, wealthy people have an obligation to try to follow a code of seemliness. No luxury cars for college-age kids. No private jet ski weekends. Live a lifestyle that is more integrated into middle-class America than the one you can actually afford. Okay, I guess, yeah. You know, sometimes you see, you know, snot-nosed trust fund brats who are spoiled and acting like they've earned it. I can see that being a bit of a gripe in America. But I kind of think, you know, just a broader problem that I would point to is just that this general sense that people in charge of large institutions and, you know, this happens in government and also, I think, in the private sector. I think Roger Goodell, I think certain religious leaders, I think certain even, you know, places like the military. Sometimes we see leaders not acting like leaders and kind of looking out for themselves and looking to cover their behinds and not holding their, you know, either blaming their underlings, deferring responsibility, passing the buck, downplaying the problem. I talk about the concept of stewardship, the idea of these things used to be considered public service, meaning that you are supposed to serve the people beneath you. You're supposed to put their interests first. I think a lot of Americans don't feel that way about their political leaders, about CEOs, about university presidents, nonprofit executives. I mean, there are a lot of people who have done quite well for themselves, while the institutions that they're running do not prosper and do as well either. So this is a long summary of a part of which I just, you know, sometimes you read a column and it just makes your head explode. And that was one of my ones for David Brooks yesterday. We'll see if there's any feeling response to it. But I think if you're wondering why the New York Times op-ed page is the way it is, maybe the fact that David Brooks is the conservative kind of reflects, you know, if he thinks things are going great, how do you think the liberals feel?
Very good point. And it goes back to yesterday's crazy martini where everybody listens to it and goes, very profound. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Very good. Good column. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a good one.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Thursday for the next Three Martini Lunch.